I want to thank you all for including me in this session, because what I'm going to talk about is a little bit different. In the U.S., we don't often think about aquaculture and farmed seafood, so I'd like to share some information about this topic and the relevance to the U.S. and occupational health and safety. And I just want to say the two previous talks were just so excellent, and I'm just so honored to be part of this session. So my name is Jillian Fry, and I work at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. I have no relationships to disclose. And to just give you an idea of where how my work is oriented, at the center, we apply a public health lens to the food system. So we work on a whole host of different issues, and we're taking into account public health, what we eat, the ecosystem, and how our food is produced, and how that all interacts together, and then also the external pressures of population growth, climate disruption, and the rest that are listed there. So I want to talk a little bit about seafood production methods, the aquaculture industry in the U.S. and the effort to greatly expand the aquaculture industry here, occupational risks associated with offshore finfish aquaculture, which is the specific form that I'll be talking about today, and also a policy analysis that some colleagues and I performed that's relevant, and some findings that were quite surprising and important for occupational health and safety. So this is what seafood production looks like globally. The light blue is wild caught seafood that is either marine or in lakes and rivers and things like that. It's mostly marine for wild caught fish. And then the dark blue is aquaculture production, which is farmed seafood. And aquaculture does not just refer to farmed aquatic animals, it also refers to seafood and algae, so it includes plants as well. And you can see from the light blue line, for the past few decades, wild-caught seafood has not been expanding at all. It's very flat line, and experts agree that we will not be able to harvest increasing numbers of seafood from the wild. That line is also deceptive. It's hiding the fact that we are fishing down the food chain in the ocean. So we are targeting smaller and smaller fish, and the climate change is also a huge unknown in terms of how our oceans will be impacted and seafood will be impacted, and this has really important implications for food security, especially in other countries in Asia and other developing countries. And you can also see that aquaculture production has been growing very quickly. It is the fastest growing form of animal production on the globe. And that's really saying something, because pork and poultry is going up very quickly as well. And there are many, many issues related to seafood production, and especially seafood farming. It involves hundreds of species, many different production methods, and it's very, very global. The U.S. is a very small player, so you really can't talk about the impacts of farmed seafood without taking into account what's happening all over the globe. And I can't get into a lot of the issues, but I just want to let you know, if you're interested in this issue, please come and see me, and we can chat all about it. So some of the main concerns with farmed seafood has to do with habitat destruction. You can see in the upper left, that's commercial shrimp farming, and mangrove forests have been cut down for that production. We also worried about chemical pollution, disease transfer from farmed fish and animals to wild fish if they're nearby, antibiotic use, which can lead to reservoirs of antibiotic-resistant pathogens that can impact workers and people who live nearby, and also global resource use. And the biggest concern there is what we're feeding our farmed seafood. So you probably hear a lot about the seafood trade deficit in the U.S. We eat a lot of imported seafood. About 90% of the seafood that Americans eat is imported. But you'll see here that we're also a big exporter of seafood. So in terms, and this includes wild and farmed, the U.S. is in the top five of seafood exporters, and that's usually surprising to people. It's because what we catch in our wild fisheries, there's a big market for that fish overseas. So we export a lot of our wild-caught seafood, and we are the number two importer of seafood in the world. And what we tend to import is farmed shrimp from Southeast Asia, tilapia, tuna, we eat a lot of that, farmed Atlantic salmon. I also want to point out, I was thinking as I was listening to the previous two speakers, the fact that we're the number two importer in the world, if you think about what goes on globally with workers and wild and farm seafood production, the U.S. potentially has a lot of power as just collective consumers to apply pressure to improve occupational protections and safety for workers around the globe. So I just wanted to mention that, but it's not the focus of my talk. And this tells you where aquaculture is happening. So this is aquaculture growth from 1950 to 2010. This is FAO data. And you can see that it's almost all in Asia, and China actually is responsible for about 60 to 70% of global aquaculture production. So they, if we want to understand what's going on with global aquaculture, we really need to understand what's going on in China. And the U.S. is responsible for less than 1% of farmed seafood production. So because of that, there's an effort at the federal level to develop U.S. aquaculture, and this has been in existence since 1980. There's a desire and a stated goal to expand U.S. aquaculture fivefold from 1999 to 2025, and this is to reduce the trade deficit that I spoke about, spur economic development, meet U.S. food needs and contribute to solution of world resource problems. And it's important to understand USDA is in charge of onshore aquaculture. That would be things like catfish production in ponds, trout production in raceways. If you have recirculating aquaculture that can be done in a warehouse, the USDA is in charge of that. And NOAA is in charge of everything that is off of our coast. So they're in charge of marine aquaculture. And I also want to point out, spurring economic development, that is really a primary reason, as I've been looking at this, and I'm sure you will not be surprised, but NOAA is located within the Commerce Department. So I really can't overstate the importance of the desire for the economic development related to farm seafood. So this is the U.S. exclusive economic zone. This is from the territorial sea to 200 nautical miles offshore. We have the largest exclusive economic zone in the world, and NOAA wants to use this for economic development, all sorts of energy exploration and those sorts of things, and also for food production. We have all this space, and NOAA has these stated goals to use it for seafood farming. Some forms of aquaculture production are highly sustainable and they're a great idea, and some forms are less sustainable. Just because we have the space to farm fish, my big question related to resource use is what will they eat? Usually we feed farmed fish ground up wild fish for the fish meal and fish oil, and then we also feed them a lot of soy, and then we need to think about all of the resources and land where we currently grow food to feed to animals, to feed to us, which is not very efficient, and now we want to use our whole exclusive economic zone to do more of that. So there are some forms that are very sustainable, but there's also problems. Generally, aquaculture in the U.S. has been regulated at the state level. So this is, we don't have a large farmed Atlantic salmon industry in the U.S., but we do have a small one off the coast of Maine and also off the coast of the state of Washington. And this is a picture off the coast of Eastport, Maine. So we do have small nearshore finfish farming. And this is regulated mostly at the state level. So almost all of the aquaculture that we have is either onshore and regulated by USDA, or it's nearshore, and the states really take the lead. There is federal involvement, but the states are taking the lead. So any movement to put farmed seafood in the exclusive economic zone, the feds will be exclusively responsible for regulating that that activity. So here's a couple pictures just to give you an idea, and I hope you can see in the middle of the slide, you can see people in a boat. So this is cages for offshore finfish aquaculture, and they're entirely enclosed, unlike the nearshore operations, and they're put underwater, and you can have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of fish in these cages. And the folks in the boat, I really like that picture because it gives you an idea of the size. So when you have that many animals in close proximity, you have disease pressures. Anytime when you put people close together, or hogs, or poultry, or fish, you have disease pressures. So we worry about the medications. The pesticides are used. Some of the disease pressures are not treated by antibiotics. Sea lice is treated by pesticides. So it's chemicals, chemical pollution. We're worried about food safety, drugs given to the animals. So those are the general concerns, and they're, of course, also related to occupational health and safety. And the size of the operation and where it is sited has a lot to do with the impacts, also the production method. So again, there's a lot of variety within aquaculture production. So let's talk specifically about the occupational health risks related to offshore production. So U.S. aquaculture workers, even though it is a very small industry, we do know that they suffer non-fatal injuries similar to agricultural workers, and we already heard that those injury rates are very elevated in agricultural work. And it's very important to note that offshore aquaculture production, you are combining agriculture, fishing, commercial fishing type activities, and also commercial diving. So people dive and they go and perform maintenance on the different cages. So those are three of the most dangerous occupations that I can think of. And when we saw in Amy's talk, the category that included agriculture, it also included fishing. So those are very dangerous occupations, and this combines a lot of the elements of those. And in general, we're worried about exposure to drugs, agrochemicals, pathogens, and extreme temperatures, falls from boats and cages, breathing in dust from the feed, musculoskeletal injuries, needle stick injuries. That's when folks have to give a fish a vaccination. They're kind of slippery, so you can stick yourself. And also diving risks, including decompression illness and drowning. And I have, because I work on aquaculture, I have news alert on when aquaculture is in the news. And every so often I get an alert and, you know, someone has drowned. It's usually not in the U.S. because we have such a small industry, but I am aware of drownings that happen around the world related to aquaculture production. So some colleagues and I performed an analysis. Previously, folks who have looked at these issues, they're usually doing an analysis looking just at environmental impacts. So we wanted to apply a public health lens and understand the federal laws that would be used to prevent, control, and monitor public health risks. One of the reasons why we did this analysis is Congress has tried twice to pass comprehensive legislation to regulate offshore aquaculture, and it has not passed. So NOAA is charging ahead with, they're going to release a permitting plan to regulate offshore finfish aquaculture in the Gulf of Mexico any day. So that's why we performed this analysis, because there is no comprehensive plan to regulate it. So what we found, we identified 20 laws that were related to offshore finfish aquaculture. 11 were the ones kinds we were looking for. Some of the others were related to illegal trade of wild animals, marine sanctuaries, those types of things. So what we found is that there are many agencies that will be involved or potentially involved. We have NOAA in the Commerce Department, the EPA, FDA from the Department of Health and Human Services, OSHA from the Department of Labor, the Coast Guard in the Department of Homeland Security, and USDA. And the big finding here was that all of these agencies are going to have to cooperate, and they're also going to have to be aware of this development and this brand new industry coming, you know, that NOAA is really trying to develop. And I don't have full confidence that that cooperation and preparation will occur. Okay, so the key findings related to occupational risks. Of course, the agricultural exemptions that we heard about earlier are very relevant. And the jurisdictional issues related to offshore fish farming was very surprising and quite important to us. So apparently, or what we found was the OSH Act is preempted past the territorial sea. And so in the exclusive economic zone, the U.S. Coast Guard has some rules related to boats, and the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has regulations related to oil rigs. So the OSH Act doesn't actually apply to the exclusive economic zone. And we did a lot of digging because we certainly didn't want to come out with this finding if it wasn't true. So I spoke to people at OSHA and they said, we don't even have boats. We don't regulate things offshore. They are highly unprepared to do something like this. OSHA wasn't even really aware of the development of this this industry and the push to develop this industry until we contacted them. Now, I will say it's possible that NOAA spoke to other people in OSHA, but the folks that we spoke to were not aware of this development. So we've communicated with OSHA, as I said, to let them know, and we've also submitted formal comments to NOAA related to their plan to develop this industry offshore. We have not seen any change in their plans and any recognition that there will be a great need for monitoring and regulating occupational health and safety and protecting workers involved with the industry, but we're hoping that as plans come out, we're hoping that we'll see that change, and we will continue to communicate with them about our concerns. And that's all. Here's our contact information. Thank you so much.
I hope the other gentleman, Jose, is in good health. And thanks for the opportunity to speak a little bit on this also. Let me give you a little bit of my background. My name is Jose Gaitan. I'm Mexican. I was born in Ciudad Juarez, the sister city of El Paso, down there in Texas. And I've been in Nebraska for the last 18 years, this last October, to where I came to find a lot of work. They call Nebraska the good life state. And that's what it's been for me. I have two backgrounds in meatpacking and also construction. So if there's any questions you got after this panel, please feel free to get in contact with me. If there's anything I can help you with what you're doing, what you're working on these days, I'll be glad to help. I took a little bit on a few notes from the previous speakers about wage theft and loss of pay for the agricultures. And it seems like that when they don't speak the language, it's really hard for them to express themselves. And I see in our workers in the meatpacking and also in the agriculture, because we do have agriculture in Nebraska, our biggest issue with their workers is trying to help them with their fear of speaking up for themselves, fear of being able to go to their employer and ask, you know, why their paycheck was short, why they're not being taken care of, why they're not getting adequate bathroom breaks. I also see that even in the meatpacking plants, it's totally changed. In the 17 years that I've been in contact with meatpacking houses, I remember there was a time where you would get an hourly wage and you would also get a piece wage for certain piece. I know now that there's no more plants that do that anymore. I remember, you know, for workers like me that would like to work in the packing houses, we would drive towards the plants that would actually pay you an hourly wage plus for the piece. And that doesn't exist anymore. That's some low-key ways of these companies that sell to other companies, to bigger companies, and they're buying themselves out. And these new companies come in and they think of ways where they can cut, you know, wages and maximize profits. Another thing that's also occurring even now to these days, when meatpacking workers dress up in the morning when they put on their PPE, their protective equipment, they are starting to take away even those minutes before work and after work. An 8-hour shift that they would pay them for that, you know, to get there, get dressed, put on the PPE, at the end of the shift, get undressed, wash and sanitize their equipment. They are starting to do away with that also. During injury time, I was speaking with one of my friends that is still working. I would ask her what it's like now to go report an injury, what it's like to go let them know that their wrists are sore, their elbows are sore. And before, years ago, you could get free pain medication, you know, just two small pills. And now they have machines outside the nurse's office where you got to put in your quarter and you got to, you know, you get your pills, and it's not free anymore. There's so many little ways that they're actually cutting back and taking a lot, I say a lot, from the worker, because you expect to be taken care of when you work for somebody for that hard. I really like the story about the two tales of the two employees, one being for a company and the other one being for the agriculture. And I want to share my story and that story of Salvador. Salvador was my roommate, and he didn't speak English well. And I got injured about a month and a half into a two-year stretch working for a company there in Grand Island. And I noticed it helped me that I knew my rights. Then that's what I'm talking about, trying to help and educate people and get them over their fears. I knew my rights. I spoke the language well, and I was able to go to the nurse. I was able to get the care. I was able to read the papers when they asked me if I wanted my own doctor or if I wanted company doctor. I elected my own doctor. And a lot of people don't know this. They don't know their rights. Sometimes they believe that if they report that they're injured, you know, they fear retaliation in that sense. And then that wasn't the story with my friend Salvador. For myself, I was able to rehabilitate. I was put on light duty, which was I was moved. I didn't get sent home for the length of my injury. I tore my left breast muscle. It wasn't a long tear. It was just enough to work out a discomforting bump here and pain for a few weeks. But then I was put on physical therapy. But I was able to rehabilitate within a couple of months, and then I was put back on my regular line. For my friend Salvador, he was working in the slaughter side of meatpacking, where there's a lot of biohazards with the cattle's blood and whatnot. The company tried to say, they did a little bit of investigation. He had just gotten back from Mexico from a trip. They tried to blame his illness on his trip, asking him questions. He had drank milk, you know, while he was in Mexico visiting family and stuff like that. What had happened to him is a cut had gotten infected from the blood on the slaughter side, and it caused him a really severe infection in his back. And I know this because he was my roommate at the time. He got in the proper, you know, health from the doctors, but they were trying to, I guess I should say, weasel out of, you know, his compensation. It took him several months. He was my roommate, my wife at the time. We would help, you know, cook for him. There were some days where he couldn't, his back pain, the infection was so bad he couldn't get out of bed. We helped him dress. We'd help him go to the doctor, to his meetings. But at one point, you know, he had gotten a lawyer, and he actually won the case, and he was able to retire. He's back with his family in Mexico. I still stay in touch with him. But that is one of the things for myself, and I know for agricultural workers, for meatpacking, for the language barrier, that there is a great fear amongst our workers of retaliation, of being laid off, even after they get hurt, to speaking up. You know, being rehired for anybody else is also a fear in that, because we try to provide for ourselves, provide for our families a better life for them. I also, in construction work, there's also that same fear. Now that I work construction, I thank, you know, Nebraska Appleseed that has given me some training. We've been to several of OSHA trainings. We're working with our communities through churches, through congregations, to try and educate others as far as their rights, as far as what to do. We've done some OSHA videos in Spanish and in English so that people understand. Nebraska is a big state on refugees, and they're translating those videos to their languages, and which kind of helps all these migrants coming into the United States to work, you know, to help them and educate them and prepare them. Because nobody goes to work thinking they're going to get an illness. Nobody goes to work thinking they're going to get hurt that day. I didn't think it would happen to me, and it happened to me. I'm glad that now I work construction. I'm glad that I'm totally rehabilitated from my hands. And as workers, there's a sense of pride in everything anybody does, from welders, fabricators, car makers, nurses. And in Nebraska, we like our beef. We like our beef, and we're proud, you know, there's a sense of pride of working for a packing house, but not at the cost of, you know, our way of life, our style of life with our family, with our kids. And I want to say to each and every one of you that's here, in all your different fields, in everything that you're doing, everything that you're preparing, from workers like us, we thank you. We thank you because you brought us so far to this point, and I know you'll keep on taking us to better places. That's all I have.
So there's a bit of time now for questions for the group. Does anybody have any?
I wanted to speak about the fish, the aquaculture. When the OSHA law was passed, we were proud that it covered the U.S., formal U.S. territories like Guam, Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico. But what are all these other islands? Is Baker Island in the Pacific? At least I never heard of it. And the Palmyra Reef? They're not U.S. territories, are they? How do we have economic zones around them?
Oh, you're asking about the formation of the exclusive economic zone?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer. I mean, I guess the picture is from NOAA, and we must have some kind of interest in the program.
Yeah, well, I am curious. We'll look it up. I read news about the Spratly Islands, and I wonder a little bit, gee, there are other islands there, Maricopa.
Yeah, that's a regular question. I don't know.
I have another question for you. I know that SeaWorld just announced plans to expand their aquaculture. How would that detract or add to workers' rights? They have a notorious history of not treating their workers well and not following the rules.
So SeaWorld, in some of their research endeavors, there's an effort to site an offshore farm in California, and I haven't seen any plans on how the occupational health and safety will be monitored or the regulations that will be followed. So just because Congress didn't pass a comprehensive regulation to regulate offshore agriculture doesn't mean that our agencies that are responsible for occupational health and safety don't need to now step up and say, okay, if you're actually going to be developing this industry, we need to develop some standards and some plans. And it shouldn't be an unfunded mandate. They should have the capacity to do that.
Right. And it seems like that would be an opportunity to put pressure on a corporation versus trying to work through,
Question in the back on this side.
In addition to the aquaculture, in addition to the hazards of those occupations, it seems like another big one is the food processing of all the fish. And some of the worker advocate groups in this country have written reports on that, but I saw that heard the Terry Gross interview where she was talking about your point that we're sending our best fish actually, instead over to China, Japan, and then bringing in the crappier local rate stuff for all of us. But also with the crab, they're catching it here, sending it to China to have it processed over there, and then shipping it back, which is just crazy on so many fronts.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So the global occupational health and safety, the power and the involvement that the U.S. has is really important. And the 90% of seafood that we eat that's imported, there is a fraction of that, like you said. It is counted as imported, but it's domestic. It goes elsewhere to be processed and then comes back. And sometimes it's just up to Canada, and sometimes it's all the way over to Asia. But NOAA apparently doesn't even track that properly, so we don't even know, and folks that I've talked to at NOAA have said that they don't know the proportion of the 90% that's imported is actually domestic. But they think, what I've heard is that the imported seafood that we eat is probably closer to 80%. So it's not a majority. But it's a bit of that fraction is actually exported and then
reimported. Garrett, and then a question over here.
Hey, yeah, I want to ask the first speaker about the organic agriculture. I wonder, who were good actors and who were bad actors, and what kind of campaigns are being done among, foodies.
Yeah. Who's good and who's bad, I probably can't answer. There's a paper by Christy Getz, who's a human geographer out of Berkeley. and she documented the California legislation that tried to close a loophole in the short handle hoe, which is a really difficult tool to use and causing all sorts of injuries. And she documents how the agricultural industry in California rallied together to stop the closure of that loophole. And then again, this book, Labor and the Locavore by Margaret Gray, I would take a good look at that. She does a great job of showing that, you know, the local food movement and the organic food movement does not equate to good labor standards. In fact, there are really bad actors in the organic industry. So she's a great reference that I would take a look at.
I'm sorry, what's the name of the book?
Labor and the Locavore.
And the locavore.
Yeah, she's New York specific, but it's a great case study on organic and local food movements and what that sort of hides in terms of labor.
Here, also in California, there is something called the Eco Food Initiative, which really is looking at labor. The PANA, Pesticide Action Network of North America, Farmer for Justice, and others are really involved with that. And we didn't get to hear from the Immokalee worker, but they're also looking at the buyer of that, which is Costco. So those are some, you know, good actors in that piece of it, which is labor and pesticides.
The fact that I can't say much more than Amy is telling. You know, we don't have a lot of information, and the good actors are often self-identified and volunteer for these standards, but it's pretty murky territory in terms of what's going on with labor.
There's a question here in the third row. Do you still have a question? Yeah.
I guess in regards to the food that originated in the U.S. is processed outside of the U.S., do you know, is the FDA tracking of that? I believe they're responsible for manufacturing, although the FDA really advocates for the consumers of their products, not the workers.
Right. The FDA is responsible for inspections, and actually Sarah was on a paper at the Center for Legal Future where they found, and our colleague Dave Love led the effort, and they were looking at comparing inspections of imported seafood and talked about how FDA really can only inspect about 2%, and they don't even use their resources strategically, you know, to best identify seafood that's unsafe. And now I forget where I was going with that. Sorry. but no, the FDA does not, to my knowledge, they don't have any data on where seafood is coming from. That's really all NOAA. I mean, they know what they're inspecting, but it would be up to NOAA if we wanted to know the portion of our seafood that is re-imported. That would be NOAA, and they don't have those numbers, or they're not sharing them.
Okay, good to know we're communicating the two agencies, FDA and NOAA.
I don't know.
Question after the woman in red?
Sorry, just to add to that. The FDA's job with imports, in that paper we compared it to Canada, Japan, and the EU, and I mean the US does an atrocious job of tracking seafood and inspecting our imports. Like doing the thing, we inspect less than 2%, but when we were doing that paper, one of the most frustrating things is when we were looking at the seafood that was rejected, they wouldn't give us the denominator. They wouldn't tell us how much was inspected. We couldn't say to you, this percentage of what was inspected had cockroaches, illegal antibiotics, you know, terrible stuff. So it made it very, very challenging to see what the overall picture was. We could only say, like, this number in this year was rejected. We don't know what the percentage was. And I believe Dave FOIA FDA, and we didn't get that information.
The environment section has challenged us to ask this question in very scale of the resources, which is how do you see climate change impacting what we've been talking about? So just curious if each of you could reflect on that for a moment.
Well, for agricultural workers in general, climate change is huge because they're an outside workforce and will be ultimately, you know, directly, you know, impacted by that. And, you know, it was interesting. I was at a panel before this one where there was a lot of discussion on climate. It was a climate change panel. It was really, really interesting. And there was someone there from NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, talking about how they're, the lack of research and how they're framing the research. And it was, I was thinking about that in listening to her in terms of, there is acknowledgement that, you know, obviously construction workers and people working outside, you know, they are a huge workforce that we need to think about in terms of climate change. But it also occurred to me too that who's the workforce that's working in construction and working in agriculture? And by and large, it's a very vulnerable population, as we've discussed. And how? And then my question back to the climate change people is, how will we think about this population in particular in terms of climate change? So ultimately, we are now, that population is now additionally vulnerable.
And the environmental refugees and influx of that and the kind of work that they'll do and how will we
do that? There's a question back here.
Can I just add a little bit to that, to the climate change question, though, because everyone should know that we don't have a national heat stress standard, and Farm Worker Justice and Public Citizen petitioned for an emergency standard because of the rising numbers of deaths in the field and heat stress, and they were just flatly denied. California and Washington do have standards that they revised, but OSHA has responded with a poster campaign. And okay, I'm talking.
Cora, thanks. There's a question back there. Yeah.
Sort of a comment, but this is like ancient history. In the 70s, there was this great act called the Agricultural Labor Relations Act in California only. And, you know, workers have it, we have to have an election within 24 hours after prior election. There was some great rights in it that was totally taken away by the inventory.
Yeah, and
anyway, it was just good to look over
it. Definitely, and that was huge. In California, stands out with the ALRA. There are some major issues such as enforcing the rulings. A lot of the time, what happens is the ALRB, which is the board that labor disputes go to in California, will rule against the employer and say, okay, you owe all these back wages, etc. And then the employer, instead of paying back wages, take the ALRB to court. They take the board to court. And so these things go on for years and years and years and years without workers getting back wages paid to them according to this original ruling. And it just goes to show you again how important the enforcement mechanism is in these solutions.
There's a question here in the front row.
I just want to say, because we are talking about workers' rights here, particularly in light of the last speaker, the issue of retaliation here is really paramount. And there is a recent decision that a group called Centro and Derechos del Migrante, which is an organization, CDM, that is based actually in Mexico, so it's a U.S. nonprofit, but people should be aware that if there are situations where you are running into workers who have rights issues and those workers have returned home to Mexico, that this is an organization that can help coordinate with folks in the state to assure that their rights are protected. And one of the things that came up, we were talking about retaliation and blacklisting. And CDM is just one case where you can actually file a case with a DOE and a COEA, you know, without any other worker who's being impacted. And a lot of times, courses just say, oh, it's a, you know, every person who's undocumented is going to be afraid. So you have to come forward with a little bit more information. And they were able to prove in this particular situation that there would be blacklisting, and the court then protected the identity of the worker who was
issue. So keep CDM in mind, it's a really great organization, and it's a resource that all of you need. So I was struck by some of the juxtaposition of the comments about organic farming, which with the worker protection standard, which is driven by FIRA and therefore requires pesticides to be involved in the discussion about good and bad actors within organic farming. I know there's people from here from the environment too, that a lot of times campaigns rely on, you know, safe production of shoes or production of food. But, you know, we think about regulatory approaches, worker protection centers, but what about the issue of the campaigns and other things that have been involved in? Because it seems to me that you need worker protection guidelines and standards, and as they get greater organic food production, they've also shown that people that tend to get organic food are also people that are kind of more receptive to messages about the impact on the environment, hopefully the impact on workers. I'm just interested in sort of how that all influences strategy. Of course, that applies to agriculture as well, because people that are often, you know, getting the fish or they're thinking of more sustainable fishing. So just sort of how that fits into sort of campaigns about kind of both health and safety as well as environmental protection or production of food.
One of the sort of the original thoughts for this panel changed a little bit. Is, you know, I come to the story that I sort of entered the scene, you know, 5 years late, but, you know, 14 years working in African regulation and getting modest gains is really like how much energy can we put into that. I'm not saying that I really believe in that fight and the need to do that. And a number of the farm worker advocates that worked on the worker protection standard, we just met last week in California with the UFW, FACUN, PANA, Farm Worker Justice, MCN, a number of groups who were really, you know, pushing earth justice of this issue. And, you know, where do we go from here? And, you know, the debate across the table for 2 days was really, really interesting because of, you know, the need for the enforcement piece of it. And then there was a big push for, like, the Equitable Food Initiative and the campaigns. And when you look at, like, the Immokalee workers who were here, I mean, they made huge gains based on a campaign that was consumer-driven, going after the big actors that are purchasing the food, realizing that there was little control over the farmer. And you know, it's been pretty incredible. Now, they were one crop focus, so tomatoes, and it needs to expand, but the campaigns are going to be our critical sort of next step, given sort of the real failure of policy and regulations. That's not to say that we don't need them and shouldn't keep fighting for them, but it is just, it's exhausting pushing the drain up the hill and getting so much progress with the campaigns. And then the question we had too to sort of think about is, okay, so what happens when the Immokalee workers get all of these really important, and the health and safety committee, and they made some really important gains, but what happens when the system breaks down, and we, you know, in terms of, we just want a case, in terms of the retaliatory stuff, so there's no regulation to protect that, and even though there's a system set up with checks and balances, what happens when we don't have regulation? So those are some of the things that we're thinking about and struggling with.
Yeah, I'll just echo that and add a philosophical spin, I guess, which is like, it's hard because those private sector campaigns are so effective. And you might want to check out the movie Food Chains that came out this past year. But then there's a matter of like, we don't want to let policy makers off the hook. I mean, just leaning on private sector solutions is, this woman I mentioned earlier, Getz, out of Berkeley, she's actually written about labeling standards for farm workers and the great potential in that, much like organic, but we all know labeling also is a huge, I mean, I know EFI has gone through like years of discussions, I mean, there are so many stakeholders, et cetera, but she gets into that and the potential of that, but also what it means to have this sort of neoliberal model of creating standards for workers and putting the responsibility on the workers to do that and letting policymakers off the hook. So it's a very interesting dynamic there.
And I'll add for seafood, the complexity of sustainable seafood really makes the worker protection, inclusion of worker protection, I think, farther off and harder to include. People don't know what seafood to eat. People don't know how much seafood to eat. There's evidence that when we rate green, yellow, red by the Monterey Bay Aquarium, it's not that the red aren't still caught and produced. The market is just elsewhere, and it's, you know, folks who can afford to buy more responsibly produced seafood will buy that, and I think it might be similar for labor practices. It's also in the U.S. it's so relevant because our seafood comes from so far away. It's not that we're eating a lot of seafood produced here, so that we're, you know, those workers are part of our community and proximate to us. So I think the complexity will make worker protection even harder in the seafood. There was an expose this year about slave labor in Asia related to the production of fish meal for shrimp farming, and that was connected to U.S. consumers because so much farm shrimp goes to the U.S. And that, you know, got attention, but, you know, where's the jurisdiction, where's the pressure, who's going to make a change and certify responsibly produced shrimp and all of that. It's very, very complex and very difficult.
There's time for one more question.
In Egypt, we are expanding in the process of aquaculture to cover the gap of the food needs. But usually, aquaculture there is implemented in shallow water, not in deep water. So the risks of decompression, sickness, and so on are not present. But we have the risks of accidents, injuries, chemical exposures, and so on. And usually the process itself is supervised by Ministry of Agriculture. However, workers are mostly seasonal and temporary with a high rate of turnover. And this is a great problem, not only with aquaculture, but with agricultural workers in general. So I want to hear about that high turnover of workforce in agriculture in the States, and how do you manage?
Yeah, what you're pointing out is so important. The context around workers who work in dangerous food-related occupations and what Sarah was talking about, as people become a little bit more privileged in society, they move on and get other safer work that pays better, and that's why it's so important to move all the way to cover all workers and protect everyone. And the similarities between fish farming and land-based agriculture, there's so many similarities there and a lot of complexity in terms of the situation globally.
Okay, I just want to keep you for one more thing and ask you a question. First of all, thank you so much for sharing your personal experience and also for coming up here very quickly with zero notice. You were talking about your increased labor, your language capacity, and how that sort of produced a better outcome than your roommates. Did you ever see workers that had decent language skills that also had bad outcomes, or that there was retaliation against them? Did you see that?
Yes. Even if you spoke or speak it well, there is certain retaliation to a certain point. Also, one of the things when the workload is too heavy and the supervisors or the men are trying, you know, to put this bigger burden on people because of line speed or not having proper staffing levels. First thing that you start to let them know, you know, we don't have the right amount of people on the table. They're like, well, you got to do your job. So that's one. Next action is, well, let's go to the office. The third one is, well, you got to get written up. And then it's three write-ups and you're done here. With people that do get injured, it's really hard for them to get rehired. I know all the applications I filled out to work for these companies, they have a really nice long page asking you before you work for them if you've gotten hurt in other other companies or in any other type of labor. And once you do get hurt, they're pretty much that's information that can be found by good employers. And but the only problem is trying to rehire after you get hurt. I mean, nobody would like a liability, after you get hurt somewhere else. A lot of people that go for surgeries, carpal tunnel, shoulder surgery, they don't even get access to other use of their hands. Even when you just speak it, because they understand, even if you speak it, you don't have probably a higher education to go do something else. After I figured out that that job wasn't for me, I quit my job with no work, and within 2 days I had to work in construction. That's on my decision, and I didn't have a lot of time to keep up providing for my family. But even if you do speak it out, they're still there.
Thank you. Thank our panelists for the